And to that, of course, I will come back. I'm sorry if the Friday excursion fragments you a little, but I have to take people when I get them, obviously. And so, that though this is fragmented, I will come back to the Bund eventually, and it will all fall in place. That's what we're paid to do, to make it all fall in place. And it will all fall in place like a little jigsaw puzzle. But first we have to examine the pieces. Now, last time I talked to you, and this I must now continue, I talked to you about the origins of Zionism, treating it quite correctly historically, as one of the alternatives eventually for the young generation of the 1860s and 70s, which grew up then, but only one of the alternatives. Don't let's magnify it. Hitler gave the Jews their state eventually, so don't let's magnify the vision. It was a minority bit. But I've been talking about the origins, and now I was talking less loud about Buber and his influence. And Buber, who gave a religious synthesis such as was needed at the time, especially after Nordau and in opposition to Nordau and Herzl. You remember that this synthesis I talked about was a synthesis of spirituality which comes to us through our special faculty that we possess to create a kind of mythos, as he calls it, taking the concept, as you will read in the Crisis book, from German thought. That is to say, our faculty to spiritualize actual events of the world. Or if you would put it in another way, to suck the actual events of the world into our soul, to spiritualize those. And through that spiritualization, we have a constant relationship with God. This relationship with God reflects itself then in the people, in the folk, not in the establishment. In the folk is typified by something vibrant, alive, and vital, Buber's Hasidim, not Mr. Orbach's Hasidim. This is the community. For Buber, therefore, the Jews are the true community, linked, if you like, by a spiritual dialogue with God. And this dialogue makes everything for a Jew part of the spirituality of the folk, the spirituality of its people. And this means, in turn, the realization of a just social order. These were the contents, briefly, of Buber's famous lectures from 1910-11, which he gave to a youth group in Prague, lectures on Judaism, which are one of the most important documents in the entire Zionist movement, untranslated, of course. The problem here is simple. The problem, which I can't go into, unfortunately, is how much this synthesis is a transference of German nationalism of the Korn des Gärtel to Jewish concerns. This problem cannot be easily solved. I just mention it rather than solving it. It is obviously the reason why Hertzberg omits Buber for all intents and purposes from his collection, just as he falsified Herzl. He omits Buber, and he omits Buber except for something very unimportant in the collection altogether. But the way in which it is not the transference of German nationalism is equally important. For, as I told you before, none of the opponents of Herzl and Nordau, no more than Herzl and Nordau themselves, advocated a parochial nationalism. Even for those who eventually triumphed in the Zionist movement, who wanted to have a spiritual impetus, for whom Buber became, in a way, a normative, the end is always basic kind of humanity. There was no doubt among these people, whether it is Weizmann, or Abraham, or Buber, or later on David Gordon, whom I'm coming to in a minute, that all people have equal rights. There was no doubt in their mind from a spiritual aspect, any more than there was a doubt in Herzl and Nordau from a liberal aspect, that the Jewish state must be a binational state, that the Jewish state must be a state in which Arabs and Jews have equal rights. That they never doubt. And there is in classical Zionism no warrant for any imperialism at all. Indeed, for Buber, and not for Buber only. The uniqueness of Israel was indeed the relationship of the folk to God. And that relationship was bound to be one of justice and peace and universalism. Because Buber put it so simply, God is the God of everyone, and not just the God of one nation or the God of another nation. God is, after all, as a God in everyone. Now, if we look at Buber's thought, we can say that Buber became one of the most influential theoreticians of the Jewish state. Only second to another theoretician, to whom I shall come in a minute, Gordon. Gordon and Buber were, I think, the most important ones, opposed, both of them in every sense, to the liberalism of Herzl and Nordau. But you can also see how the thought like Buber's was an anti-liberal alternative to the young Jews of the turn of the century, just as the anti-liberal alternative of socialism or German nationalism, any nationalism, which I talked about before. What about socialism itself? It is clear from what I have said that neither Hadamard nor Buber were socialists in the Marxist sense. Clearly also, the socialist impetus in Zionism did not come from the West. If Jews were socialists in the West, they became the kind of socialists I've discussed earlier, the kind of ethical socialists who joined the socialist party. They didn't become Zionists. For them, being in the classical Marxist tradition in this regard, nationalism and socialism were obviously incompatible. That must be clear. But in Eastern Europe, after all, matters were different in the pale in that kind of Jewish society. Their socialism made headway, both in the Bund, which, as you remember, was anti-Zionist, indeed, and the biggest socialist organization, and even among the Zionists. The problem of socialism and Zionism is, I think, an obvious problem, and it was so for these people in Eastern Europe. Why should a socialist want to settle as a Jew on Jewish land? In socialist theory, that just doesn't make sense. There is no warrant in socialist theory. It is an internationalism, a humanism. But why a Jew as a Jew? Something to be abolished anyway, as you will see with the end of capitalism. As to settle on Jewish land, that is a difficult problem. It was especially grave as the socialist theories in the Austrian Empire denied Jewish nationality. And Zionist socialists always looked to the Austrian Empire. They said, look at the Czechs, look at the Bohemians, look at the Habsburgians, all of these were the Poles, all of these are socialist movements and autonomy. All of that, the socialists want them to have autonomy, they want to be socialist Poles, socialist Czechs, and autonomous people. But unfortunately, the Austrian socialists denied Jewish nationality, even if they informed others, a point to which I shall return later and not now. And the grounds that they denied it, which concern us immediately, is that the Jews Jews had no territory. And of course, the Jewish question would vanish with capitalism. Therefore, in socialist thought, while you must push for the autonomy of Poles, Hungarians, Czechs, Jews have no such claim to autonomy. And that's what Jewish socialists was pretty depressing, for the Austrian Empire was really, in a way, the model for Zionists of the nature. How then could they justify this odd combination between Zionism and socialism? Here you will read in Herzberg the two leading people on this side, Borochov and Zirkin, the two leading people, Borochov and Zirkin, and I think you will agree that their argument is tortured in the extreme, and I think rather flimsy. The essence of their argument is this, that the proletariat, any proletariat, needs a territory on its own in order to unfold the class struggle, a place in which to work. Now the answer to that is, from a socialist point of view, is really rather simple. You say the proletariat needs a territory of its own to unfold the class struggle. Okay, if you are a nation like the Czechs or the Poles or the Bolivians, that makes sense. But why do the Jews need it? The Jews are not a nation. The Jews will vanish in the class struggle. So why do the Jews need it? That is, of course, the answer. And from a socialist point of view, a perfectly proper answer. As a matter of fact, all this contortion was unnecessary. For Zionist purposes, this was rather stillborn, especially as far as the Palestinian reality was concerned. But always there will be a Marxist impetus in diaspora Zionism. For we shall have to come back to the most important political party which had this impetus, and to which I shall come back in another connection in some detail, if you like, the Jewish Proletarian Party, the Paoli Zion, the other way around, Zion, the Jewish Proletarian Party, that will always exist. But the reality of settlement was another matter that was found to defeat Orthodox Marxism, and indeed did defeat it. The Poale Zion of Borochov and Zirkin was a diaspora party. In the reality of Palestine, it was never very effective. But inasmuch as it is a diaspora party, it is important, as it is a Jewish proletarian party, it is important in spite of the fact that you will fill it, find its rationalization, I think, rather contorted. The kind of socialism which was to be of lasting influence in Palestine was not to be Marxist at all. The kind of influence which did withstand the reality of settlement was not a Marxist socialism. For that is intimately connected with the founding and the growth of the kibbutzim, obviously. The kibbutzim movement founded in 1909 with Dagania, the first kibbutzim. And indeed, if you look at the kibbutzim movement from the beginning, it had pragmatic as well as ideological reasons for being, if you like, a socialist society. Pragmatic reasons, pioneering, security, the dangers of disease, malaria, and swamps. All this was important for making a socialist a community. The ideology of a proletarian revolution was, under these circumstances, and proved to be so, somewhat ridiculous. But what was not at all ridiculous was socialism which did not come from Marx, a socialism which exalted nature the soil, the idea of working with your hand, your own hand. The inspirer of this was not Photoshop or Silke, actually rather recent rediscovery by so-called Jewish radicals. The important one here were not there for, but instead Aaron David's Gordon. And I must say that Gordon's importance is probably greater than Buber's, but is in a way of this time of a Zionist ideology, of a spiritualism against the liberalism of Herzl and Gordon, of incalculable importance and consequence. Just as I would say the same thing for Buber's thought. Remember always, as I have said before, that the Jews were a people in quest of a nationality. You've studied emancipation. You've studied all this. You know that religious orthodoxy, even in Eastern Europe. You know that from Mr. Orbach, what's going on. So what was left? The Jews were a people in quest of a nationality. You must always put that in context. And while Herzl and Nordau say, we give you liberalism, the liberalism that then in Europe you can play out in Palestine, the others had to find a spirituality. They couldn't be a religious one, because that was pretty dead. So you have Buber's, and so you have Gordon, and so you have Voroshilov, and all the others. For Gordon's socialism came, of course, not from Marx, but from Tolstoy. It was nothing to do with Marxian socialism. His idea is best put in the title of his most famous work, Salvation, the famous book, Salvation Through Work. What did he mean by Salvation Through Work, which refers itself to Tolstoy and not to Marx? He did not mean what Herzl meant. Not the free enterprise, which plays such a large part in the Jewish state. For Gordon condemned money as the essence of unfreedom, the essence of alienation. The way back from unfreedom, the way back from alienation, is to work with your hands. Why? Because only work with your hands re-establishes an organic relationship to nature. Now contrast that with Marx's famous saying about the idiocy of the countryside. Poor Karl Marx in London had not as much feeling for nature as I don't know what. He had none whatsoever. He was a complete urbanite, our Marx. He had no feeling for nature. He went to Eastbourne to take to the Eastbourne. Oops, that shows pretty bourgeois taste in the first place. He went to Eastbourne not to contemplate the ocean as you and I might go to Eastbourne. We wouldn't go to Eastbourne, but he went to Eastbourne because of the healthy air. It was when Marx went to nature, it was a health measure. When Gordon talks about nature, it is an end to alienation. So work with your head, because the true socialism is an organic socialist. Work with your hands, making the Jew part of nature, renews you through what he calls a natural life. Work which is not alienated. He condemns Marxism, of course, as mechanical, artificial, and he realized what I just said, that it is of necessity opposed to Jewish nationalism, of necessity of hope, as Gordon quite rightly saw. What is needed instead is a renewal of life through the cosmic forces of nature. And this renewal works on two ways. It works to renew you as a person through your work with your hands. It transforms you from a coffee house Jew to an agricultural Jew. And all that that meant, and I've already told you, as far as the stereotype is concerned. But secondly, it is work with your hands in a peculiar nature, your landscape, the nature of Palestine. Therefore, by becoming an organic man, you become an organic Jew. Because that work, that total organic, is done in your land. Turaba, again, Tolstoy, but not Tolstoy only. The idea of a reform of life, Nagel's reform, you will read in the Crisis book. That is to say, reform through nature was a great slogan in the industrialization at the end of the century. All nationalism adopted it in one way or another. Secondly, the idea that this renewal is through your landscape, all nationalism adopted as well. The German youth movement, about which you will read, tried to get that renewal from its landscape, the Germanic landscape, which Gordon tried to get in a way from the landscape of Palestine. But there is one difference. Gordon was wicked a socialist in the Tolstoyan sense. That renewal must be based on manual labor. And manual labor excludes money. Money which is evil, artificial, unorganic. Therefore, it must exclude labor. That must be quite clear. Working on the land. Such a people working on the land will, moreover, here we're back with my theme, respect all other people. It humanizes you. And especially, he believed, for brotherly coexistence with the Arabs. Like all these people, he was what we would call a bi-nationalist, a humanizer. Now, in the rest of Europe, here again a difference, as you will read in the Crisis book. Here again a difference. There, this organic relation to nature tended to become aggressive, tended to become a parochial nationalism. But Gordon was saved from that by the Tolstoyan element, by the element of his peculiar kind of humanitarian socialism. It were these ideas which became vital in the kibbutz movement. This kind of nationalism, this kind of socialism. Now it is clear that here again the class struggle is beside the point. The class struggle is beside the point. In the foreground stands the soil and salvation through work. That must be clear as well. Moreover, this kind of Zionism, which Gordon typifies, was a real alternative for many young people, anti-liberal, anti-mechanical. It had this idea of organic that was so important to many of the youth revolting against bourgeois society towards the end of the 19th century. Gordon's influence, like Boomer's, will vanish with the time, but I still heard a wonderful Gordonist speech by the late Speaker of the Knesset, and he got an honorary degree at the Hebrew University, Katz, gave a wonderful Gordonist speech about the importance of working with your hands, the importance of the organic relationship with nature, and all of that sort of thing, which becomes very important. To summarize, then, we must say, as far as the origins of Zionism is concerned, first of all, the revolt against Council and Nordau had to try, but it did try. You will read in Herzberg many alternatives, but the two most important people to give Zionism, early Zionism, its ideology, its nationalism, the Father Jahn and Treitschke, if you like, of Israel nationalism, were Buber on the one hand and Gordon on the other. And you can see their difference with Father Jahn and Treitschke, very obvious. Marxist socialism was, in many ways, still born, though in the end, as you will see, if you come back to that, it found a home. A home not so much in a proletarian Jewish party, but in a social democratic Jewish party. If you can still call that Marxist, very doubtful, but in a social democratic Jewish party, the Mapai. And I shall come back to that. But that doesn't relate itself to Borisov and Sergei. The real radicalism at the beginning of Zionism was brought on. And to a certain extent, Buber, that was the real radicalism at the beginning of the Zionist movement. The problems involved are two, always, you must keep in mind. One is, how much is Jewish or not? Very important question. You know, just as blacks today, also in search of a nationality. Only Jews were 100 years before that in search of a nationality. But it's very similar to blacks, what I'm telling you today. I told you. What is it? How Jewish can the heritage be once you reject Jewish religion? How Jewish can it be? A very difficult question. Therefore, the question is, how much was it a transference of German nationality ideas or Russian Tolstoyan ideas? And the answer must be, there was a great deal of that in it. A great deal of that in it, from beginning to the end, as far as Zionism is concerned. A great deal. By the outbreak of the First World War, by 1914, Zionism then was an alternative, but not a very important one. What gave Zionism a shot in the arm was the war. Come to that in a minute. And of course, above all, the Balfour Declaration of 1918, which gave Zionism a shot in the arm, as it were. And together with it, the growth of anti-Semitism after 1918. But we must never lose perspective. This was a minority movement among respectable Jews, especially. I remind you again the typical story of the Scholem family. Mr. Scholem, a leading Berlin notable in the Berlin Jewish community, who had no luck with his children. That's not you that you have no luck with your children. Who had no luck, he had two fine sons. One became a communist and the other a Zionist, and they were both expelled from the home. For the Scholem, there was no difference between them. However, only the Zionist one survived. The communist one was murdered by Stalin, eventually. By two sons, communist and Zionist, by the notables, regarded as equally mixed, if I can put it that way, really are. So you mustn't forget that this is a minority of things. The real alternative were still the socialist alternative and the nationalist alternative. But the Balfour Declaration, and after 1918, the increase of anti-Semitism, these gave Zionism a shot in the arm, but it was a minority in Eastern Europe as much as in Western Europe. As we now stand in 1914, we have laid the foundation to what is to come. Let me summarize a little more, for we are now in a kind of watershed. The 19th century had seen then Jewish emancipation, the rise of modern anti-Semitism and its development. At the same time as modern anti-Semitism developed, the alternatives open to a new generation can be discerned, and we have discussed them. Complete assimilation, socialism, Zionism. The new movements which arose out of the anti-Semitic way of the 80s and 90s, especially with Herzl and Nordau. Remember, that was the case, rather than any deep spiritual impulse. What about the war? The war deepened these effects, and especially in Germany, for it brought the East European tale of settlement under German occupation. What did that mean, that it brought the East European tale of Jewish settlement under German occupation? It meant a shock to German Jews who first came into contact with it as part of the German army in Poland. It reinforced for many what they had already read in the ghetto literature of the 19th century. And moreover, the German authorities rejected the request of the Jews for national autonomy. Germany in the war was preoccupied with trying to resurrect a new Polish state, and so they refused national autonomy to the Jews in Poland, with dire consequence for the Jews, for eventually they were left at the mercy of a resurrected Polish state. But here too, Jewish autonomy was rejected. There is therefore a double effect, First of all, the ghetto came to the notice of more people than ever before. And second of all, national autonomy was refused. Millions of Jews were eventually delivered up to the Poles without protection of minority status. The Balfour Declaration, remember, only applied to Palestine. But within Germany, there was an event which was to have very grave consequences, more individual than general, and that was during the war. This event was that in 1916, the Ministry of War ordered a count of Jews who were at the front. That is a statistic name of Jews at the front, the famous Judenzähler, or counting of Jews at the front. This was traumatic for many German Jews. For the Jewish soldier, this isolated him, even in battle, from the camaraderie of his fellow soldiers. It produced many leading Zionists, and Simon is one of them, who through this count came to Zionism. But why this statistic? Partly, no doubt, to counter the propaganda that Jews were not fighting, but making profits at home. Partly it was undoubtedly a matter of rather goodwill to encounter anti-Semitic propaganda that Jews were making profits when other people were fighting. And indeed, the central organization of German Jews, that central organism, used it in order to praise Jewish patriotism. But in reality, it had quite a different effect. In the field, at the front, it seemed it was taken by officers as an order that Jews were to be sent into battle on a, if you like, preferred schedule, that Jews were to be evicted from all non-combat positions and sent into combat. Now, obviously, this famous Jewish statistics in the middle of a war, which Jews and others were fighting presumably equally at the front, can show us that with all of this, anti-Semitism was not only dead, but it was indeed reviving. And that the retreat of anti-Semitism from 1900 on, which I mentioned earlier, was merely and proved merely a temporary retreat from anti-Semitism, proved merely to be something temporary. For 1918 deepened this trend. It is not only that we find such anti-Semitism in the common war effort, but it seemed also to many, and rightly, that the revolutions which followed the war were dominated by Jews, that series of revolutions from 1918 to 1920 was Jew-dominated, as indeed it was. Quote Eisner and the Bavarian Revolution, mostly Jews in that. The Hungarian Revolution, the Lacoon, and the whole of the police bureau were Jews to a man. In fact, it was said that Hebrew was the language of Hungarian communism. Not totally, not at all without reason. You must remember that this would be very important. And indeed, in all of the revolutions of 1918-1920, the Jews seemed to dominate, indeed to produce them. And indeed, these revolutions, with the exception of Hungary, Well, revolution, which indeed were produced spontaneously almost by people who were ethical socialists. This was the one time that these Jews, whom I talked about before, saw the political light of day. This is Rosa Luxemburg in Berlin, after all. This is Kurt Eisner and Toller in Bavaria. These were all out of the socialism that I have tried to explain to you before. That is where they all came out of, as it were. And this was their one idea of the sun. But remember the impression that made of the Gentile community. These Jews did not think of themselves as Jews, of course, not at all. But still, they obviously were, and everybody knew it. The result was, in 1918, of course, a strengthened anti-Semitic reaction. Jews and revolution were now closely bound up in the public mind. That must be clear. And from the beginning, from 1918 on, Jews and revolution were quite rightly in the public mind, quite rightly bound up in the public mind, quite rightly. And this will continue so. So again, as you will see, Jews will not be a part of the established party. The Communist Party in Germany rightly prided itself that it had no Jews in its central committee. It made that statement again and again throughout the 20s. And the Social Democrats, though they never made such a statement, it was nevertheless true in practice. I shall come back to that next time. So that what you have is that it was true that a result of the war was not only strengthening Zionism, which it undoubtedly did, with a powerful declaration, strengthening anti-Semitism through the pale Eastern Europe being drawn in still more in the West. It's important when we come to it later. And not just to strengthening anti-Semitism again through the revolutions after the war, in which Jews played a leading and sometimes, I must say, a sole part. It also brings us back again to the fact that the Jews who made these revolutions were indeed precisely the young people who'd gone in for the alternative I had mentioned in the 1860s and 70s. The founders of an ethical socialism, Eisner in Bavaria, the ethical socialist, I mentioned him last time, Toller, in a sense, even Rosa Luxemburg, all of these. It was their one time in the sun. They were never going to have a time in the sun again, of course. Never to have a time in the sun again. When we come now to what we must call Europe between the wars, that is Europe 1918 to 1939, to Europe between the wars, how will we proceed? And I must now be quite clear about that. I'm trying to give you the minimal confusion. How will we proceed? We will now proceed topically. What I mean by that is, we shall first talk, starting next Friday, about Jews and about socialism and the Jews. And for that, I will have to go back a minute to Kautsky before the war. To that, I shall have to go back a little before the war, and we must talk about socialism and the Jews. Then we must talk, obviously, about fascism and the Jews. Not such a simple thing as you sometimes think. Jews were fascists in quite a large number, not just Mussolini's mission. So, you have, therefore, fascism in the Jews, then liberalism in the Jews, which will deal with the Jewish establishment, of which you have heard a piece already by Mr. Weinberg's French Jewish establishment. Then we must come to the Jews themselves. Finally, in all of this, we must stress the general movement's attitude to the Jews. When I'm through with that, I want to come to the Jews themselves again. By that time, it'll be May. And if we still have time, we shall come then to National Socialism and the Holocaust. But let me say two things about that right now, because I know some of you are very disappointed that I'm not going to do much with the Holocaust or National Socialism. National Socialism, you can come in here in History 120. With the Holocaust, that I don't do much with the Holocaust. There is a reason here. One is a reason of time. The other reason is, in effect, on my part, partly education. Do not be blinded by the Holocaust. That awful event, as we see it now, was not so much a discontinuity of Jewish history, except in one effect, it gave us the state of Israel. No doubt about that. It gave us the physical state of Israel. Not the mental state of Israel so much as the physical state of Israel. That I reckon. But what I must make clear to you, who are disappointed, that all the attitudes that we are discussing and have discussed, they go on. Surely every attitude that we've taken up historically in this class, you find today. And when we come to socialism at some length, that leads, of course, into Soviet anti-Semitism directly, which is going on. And indeed, when we come to fascism and liberalism, this is much more important for our point of view than the fact of the Holocaust or the organization of the Holocaust. So I don't want you to be blinded by this awful event. Historically, from an overview of the course of Jewish history, awful though it was, its effects happened to be limited, especially in a cultural and ideological thought and cultural and ideological realm. It is true that some draw the wrong analogies from it, like the Jews' Defense League. The wrong analogies, and even the State of Israel, draw the wrong analogies from it now and then. Therefore, I want to say a few things about the Holocaust. But what is really crucial for Jewish history are the things that we are hitting in this course, because that will form the attitude, if you like, of the Jewish survival. In other words, that will go on, as a matter of fact, on to form attitudes, as you know, as today. So that is why I am putting the emphasis really on the times before 1933, because that's when everything is set, and it won't change that much before 1933. And all that I want to deal with then in the Holocaust, eventually, a Jewish attitude, and I will say something about it, about the very vexed and partly very mistaken these days ideas of Jewish resistance. That I think has to be put straight. Because that is these days very doubtful work is being done on that. So I will talk about that in these regards, but otherwise I will go on to socialism and the Jews, and any questions you have you can ask on Friday. The Friday will be present.